session number 10671. Real one.
Callback's a real one. Can you tell me something about your family background to start off with and its connections with India?
Well, my connections with India go back really far to Sunway, and not entirely in the army, right back to Clive's day. But in fact, to come more up to date, my grandfather, assumes that my grandfather, was born in the residency in Lucknow at the height of the mutiny. He was the son, as it transpired, of a young gunner couple, British gunner couple, who had come out to Lucknow, had got stuck in the residency, and the wife gave birth in cellars under terrible conditions, and gave birth to this child at about the same time as her husband, who was a subaltern in the gunners, was killed. And so the such wives as were there, and other people were there, came to the conclusion that this must be the son, because two other children were born at much the same time, must have had the name of Baxter, which was the name of this kind of couple. But that was my grandfather. And I do just remember my grandfather up to the age of, at about the age of three or four, as a very tall, rather stately gentleman. And my father was one of 13, and the rest of the family were in various branches of India, the IMS, PWD, and so on. And so really, with all the uncles that I had and so on, various branches of India, I had a fair groundwork and grounding, if you like, of the whole Indian setup, which is immensely helpful.
Were you educated in India?
No, no. I was educated in this country. I went to Dulwich College Prep School from 1922 to 1927, when I went to King William's College, Isle of Man, from 27 to 30, and from there to Sandhurst.
Why did you decide to go in for the army?
Well, really, because I can't imagine I had two brothers. My father was a very dyed-in-the-wood army officer, and I can't imagine doing anything else. There was no question of going to civilian life. No one in the family had ever been in civilian life, wouldn't have known where it began. And so one took it for granted that, certainly he did, that any sons he had, and I had two brothers, both of whom also became regular army officers, would go into the army. There was no question of doing anything else.
How did you find your Sandhurst training? Did you find it adequate for what was to come later?
The trouble about the Sandhurst training at that time was that there was a socialist government in power. They treated Sandhurst, and I'm talking about 1931, they treated Sandhurst as a university. The question that it was anything to do with the army was incidental. It was at a time also when we were in, there was economic trouble in the country, which I remember well. We went off the gold standard, though I really didn't understand what the gold standard meant, but I know everybody talked about it. But one of the troubles about Sandhurst in those times, believe it or not, it's almost impossible to believe, I never fired a single weapon all the time I was at Sandhurst. What I didn't know about marching up and down and riding, equitation and PT and so on, what I didn't know about, well, gradually about the gold standard and economics and so on, but when it came to actual military training and dealing with weapons, looking back on it, it was really quite extraordinary. When I got to my British battalion in India, the Sherwood Foresters, when I first went out to India, I didn't know how to, hardly knew how to fire a rifle or any form of light machine gun or throw a grenade. It was most embarrassing. I was supposed to teach a platoon with men who'd got 25, 30 years' service, and there was I never having fired any of these weapons at all.
What do you think the reason for that was? Do you think it was because the officer wasn't actually supposed to kill people, but to lead other people to kill people?
No, I think it goes back to the whole socialist influence that there was then, as regards Sandhurst. Very soon afterwards, when the socialists went out of power, then Sandhurst became, as one would expect Sandhurst become, and that is a military training establishment, and not as a so-called university, which was what the socialists wanted. They wanted less of any sort of military influence and more on seats of learning and that sort of thing.
Who do you remember in the way of personalities at Sandhurst, either on the staff or as fellow cadets?
Well, there are some quite famous fellow cadets. There is General Sir Walter Walker, who was a personal friend of mine, who went out to Sandhurst at the same time. We were both in the 2nd Battalion of the Sherwood Foresters at the same time, the same company, and so on. I remember him well. And it so happened that his elder brother was in fact the adjutant of the 1st 8th Punjab Regiment, which I was to join later. Now, other people I can remember is the person whose name escapes me at the moment, Military Secretary of the Queen Mother. He's often quoted. He's about my age group. I'm afraid the name is gone for the moment. But she's very fond of him and is her sort of military secretary. Now let's see who else. Chartrist, Michael Chartrist. He was at Sandhurst with me. I knew him quite well. He's a provost of Eton, I think I'm right in saying at the moment. He's about to retire. There was Ponsonby, you'll notice there are all these sort of title families in a way. They all were in those days. I mean, a very high percentage of them were at Sandhurst. He did very well in a cavalry regiment. He's a very fine horseman. Those are the ones that really spring to mind. The other, when you come to the actual staff, the one that spring to mind is Norman Gwatkin, who was in fact adjutant at my time, and was quite famous for his riding up the steps on his white horse and so on at the end of parade. A magnificent figure of a chap we were convinced always wore stays, because no one could possibly have a figure as straight as that. Even after a party the night before. But those are sort of characters one remembers.
How did Walter Walker make out at Sandhurst at the time, from your recollection of it?
I would have said he was always, of course, a very dedicated soldier, and a very fine soldier. I always understood that he's the most decorated soldier that's been, well, since the war, actually. Sadly, at the moment, he's very seriously ill. But yes, he was really a chap. The army was everything. Nothing else mattered. He was not the slightest bit really interested in a social life and so on. He was always studying for some sort of exam, whether it was a language exam or whether it was the next stage of an army exam, whether it was for getting into the Staff College at Quetta. It was just study, study, study as far as he was concerned. And, of course, it's paid off. If ever there was a chap who had a knapsack, or what you would call the thing, a stick in his knapsack, that was him. It stood out a mile.
One gathers from what one reads that some of the cadets there were much more interested in social life than
soldiers. Oh, they were. There's no doubt about it. Yes, yes. I mean, I must be absolutely frank myself. I never thought for a moment I'd like it to become a general or anything like that. I was prepared, and I think I speak for about the majority of them, to do my stuff, a reasonable job of work, but I was going to enjoy myself at the same time. Where I think Walter Walker's attitude, of course, was rather the other way around. Any sort of social life was unfortunate, just had to be, but he was purely interested in anything to do with the army and training and so on.
What was discipline like amongst the cadets there?
Oh, very tough indeed. But of course, a lot of it was spit and polish. For instance, when you first went to Sandhurst, the great thing was cleaning your leather, and you were given these this leather, your belt, your Sam Brown sword, and so on, boots, and all of it. You didn't describe it as getting a good shine. You had to get a surface. Now, a surface is a great expression in those days at Sandhurst, which was, I can only describe, as a very deep polish, not just any slight shine on the top. It was no question of handing these leather bits and pieces to your batman. You had one batman looked after about three cadets. He would never be able to produce a standard which would pass. and until your leather had passed, you were not allowed out of the grounds of Sandhurst. And it was well known that however good you were and however hard you worked with your leather, you would not get out of Sandhurst for about the first 6 weeks or 2 months. So it was a big moment when your leather was passed by an under officer, and you were free then to go out on Saturdays and Sundays. Otherwise, you stayed in, you're going on cleaning your leather.
What do you mean by an under officer?
Well, you had senior under officers at Sandhurst, I think it's one per company. We had four companies at Sandhurst in my time. And then he was a senior under officer, and then you had four junior under officers. And they really, to a large extent, rule the roost as regards discipline. You're pretty frightened of those chaps. And in a way, it made life very much easier for the regular staff in running a company, your company sergeant majors, your company commanders and that sort of thing, running the company. It was really almost, in a sort of a way, at a public school, you have prefects and prepositors and things like that, who, after all, are the ones who basically, down on the ground, produce the discipline. And this is what was being done at Sandhurst. And it was all tradition. You arrived there and you wore a cloth cap, and you never took your cloth cap off from the moment you arrived for the first 6 weeks or so. The only time you took it off was when you were having a meal or when you went to bed and when you went to your room. The rest of the time you kept your cloth cap on the whole time. And if you were found without it, then you're in rare trouble.
What kind of a cloth cap was it?
Well, a flat cap, like everybody wears today. An Andy cap, if you see what I mean.
Like a ratting.
We call it a gore blimey. Always known as gore blimeys there. And you wore your gore blimey the whole time.
What was meant by the term gentleman cadet?
Well, the term gentleman cadet meant that, of course, an officer in those days was always known as an officer and a gentleman. It was taken for granted. That was it. It was not particularly the class that you came from. I'm not suggesting that for a moment. Though there was an element of that. In fact, in those days, cadets, I would have thought that 90% of them came from public schools, perhaps 95%, all the rest from grammar schools and that sort of thing, and a very small percentage, I would think at about 2%, who came up through the ranks. You could come up through the ranks arrive as a cadet at Sandhurst, provided you had done a year in the ranks. Then you had to be very, very good material in order to do it, because the competition was enormous. And when you got to Sandhurst like that, it meant that your parents did not pay a penny for you there. You've got to remember, in those days, one's parents paid. It came from, the course was about 18 months, was 18 months. All the equipment and your clothing and your all the uniform, which is magnificent, fitted, and nothing from a quartermaster's store or anything like that. The whole course would cost about £450, which is a lot of money in those days. And the people who wouldn't pay, who didn't have to pay, were these Y cadets, as they were known, who were the ones who had rather specially selected, came up through the ranks. And a few unusual people, one was myself. I was an Indian Army cadet. If you're an Indian Army cadet, you only became an Indian Army cadet if your father had done exceptional service, not necessarily become a general, done exceptional service in the view of the powers that be, and had also got two sons, who were likely to go in the army in order to keep it going. You then became an Indian Army cadet, of which there were only about, I think, two given in to a year at the most. And they didn't, there was no cost to them either. Must remember that at Sandhurst we got no pay. Now that would be unheard of today. We were supposed to get 1 6 2 shillings a day as cadets, but we never saw the money because it was just disappeared in messing and food and all the rest. We never actually got any cash at all, so we had to get pocket money from our parents or wherever it was.
What did the Y stand for?
Do you know, I honestly can't remember. I really can't remember. Young cadets, but I know they were called Y cadets.
So, Why cadets weren't gentlemen cadets?
I would have said they were. Now, the sort of person who's a Y cadet happens to be a great friend of mine called Jackman, Joe Jackman. Now, his father was a clergyman, and who couldn't possibly afford the 400 and whatever it is pounds. And so his only chance of coming into Sandhurst was by the means I told you, going through the ranks. Now, he was just as much a gentleman as anyone else. It's just his father could not afford it.
How did the cadets treat each other? Did they treat each other tolerantly, or were they intolerant of unorthodoxy?
Where they were intolerant they all got on very well, but if they thought that a person had let the side down, for instance, in competitions. Now, you used to get in equitation, in competitions, one company against the other. There were other drill competitions and so on. Now, for equitation, it meant a competition riding over sticks, as we called it. Quite complicated stuff, looking at almost the sort of stuff that you see in this Horse of the Year show, where you've got a series of jumps, where you had to quit and cross your stirrups and so on and go over. Now, to those of us speaking personally, I'd never had anything to do with a horse in my life. It was all right for the county people who rode to hounds and so on, but not easy for a person like myself. Now, where you got a person who lacked guts, his courage suddenly went, and he wouldn't quit and cross his stirrups at the last moment. Now, that would probably mean that we would lose the competition, lose points. Now, he would have one hell of a time. He really would. Because he felt he'd let the show down. They didn't mind so much if he came off, but he hadn't got the guts to have a go at it. And those are the times when I must admit they were very intolerant. They used to throw cadets in the lake and that sort of thing at dead of night and so on.
So it was lack of courage rather than incompetence.
That's it, yes, yes. They would not take lack of courage. If you failed, that's fine. If you had a go, well, that's right with everybody. If you hurt yourself when having a go, they'd be the first. These cadets would be all around you supporting. But if you really didn't have a go, then... And particularly, of course, in one case, I don't think I ought to give the name of this case, he might still be alive, having had rather a bad time, he ran away. Now, that is very unheard of at Sandhurst, and had to be brought back by his father 3 days later. Now, I was desperately sorry for that chap.
Why did he run away?
Well, because he'd had a rather rough time and been thrown in the lake for failing to try at a particular competition, or in the view of the cadets.
How was he treated when he came back?
Well, pretty roughly, you see. I'm not saying he's beaten up, but, you know, you can snide remarks and making life as difficult as you possibly could.
What about if somebody was a bookworm and a swot? How did they regard that?
Well, he was just laughed at, really. There weren't very many of them, not in those days. We didn't have those sorts of much.
But, for example, would Walter Walker have been regarded as a swot?
Well, do you know, he wasn't actually in my company. He was in four company, I was in one company, I remember it well. He was keen, but his swatting really started when he left Sandhurst and was in the Sherwood Foresters with me in India. That's when it started. And of all things, in India, you had to try and pass your higher and lower standard Urdu within 2 years of arriving in India. If you did not pass the higher and lower standard of Urdu, and that means not just talking, but having to write the script, Arabic script, fairly tough, unless you're good at languages. If you did not pass that within 2 years, you were sacked. It was not a question of joining the British Army. You were finished, because you'd signed on for the Indian Army and you'd failed for the Indian Army. And that was the end of the story, as far as the powers that be were concerned, as regards the Army. And he, Walter Walker, was quite prepared in a very hot station, one of the hottest stations in the world, called Multan in the Punjab, where it was, I can remember, a temperature of 130 degrees in about June and July. It was practically impossible to sleep at night, except for 2 hours. One had to be on parade at 5 o'clock in the morning to try and get it a bit cool. And he would have his munchie riding up, his chap who was going to teach him the language, at 2 o'clock in the morning. In order to study the language from 2 till, he had to go on parade and get ready for parade about 4:30. I mean, that's absolutely unheard of at that age and stage. This is where I particularly remember his keenness and his swatting and so on. I don't really know what he did at Sandhurst, but I think he was just like everyone else there.
Now, you were an Indian Army cadet, so did that mean that you were destined for the Indian Army?
It had to be. No. Because I had accepted the fact that I was an Indian Army cadet, there was no question of my going anywhere else. Because, after all, that was the reason that they'd given it to me and so on, and I couldn't sort of change my mind or anything like that. If I had changed my mind, I'd have been finished. There'd be no question of going to the British Army.
So how did the Sherwood Foresters come into it then?
Because every cadet, when you're going to the Indian Army after Sandhurst, had to do a year with a British battalion in India. And they were known as the unattached list for the Indian Army, ULIA. And you went in groups of four. Two British battalions were out there for the very sensible reason that you were quite useless to an Indian battalion. A, you knew nothing of the country, and you knew nothing of the language. In fact, you were just a burden to the really relatively few British officers that you have in an Indian battalion, which has never averaged, in my experience, more than about six or seven. If you're going to have a youngster joining, you've got to spend right off one or two of your British officers trying to train him at the same time. It's obviously it's not viable. And so you went out to India. 50-something of us went out to India in my group in 33. And you were posted in groups of four to British battalions all around India. And you stayed with them for a year. And then from there, from your British battalion, you were posted to your Indian battalion.
So were the Sherwood Foresters allocated to you, or did you have some choice?
Well, I had some choice in that the Sherwood Foresters and my future battalion, the 1st 8th, were both stationed in Multan. And in fact, my father was a station commander there as well. So altogether, you see, there was some choice. And Walter Walker and I, as an example, went down. In fact, we shared the same bungalow in Multan, and we were in the same company, C Company, of the Sherwood Foresters, 2nd Battalion of the Sherwood Foresters there. He went to the 1st 8th Gurkhas, I went to the 1st 8th Panjabis.
So your year with the
Foresters,
with the 1st Battalion of the Sherwood Foresters,
2nd.
2nd Battalion,
yes,
of the Sherwood Foresters, was 33-34.
That's right. That's right. From about February, January, February 33 to right the beginning of 34, February 34.
So it came about because the Sherwood Foresters just happened to be at Multan at the same time as the 1st 8th Punjab Regiment.
And yeah.
You were allocated for that because your father was...
Well, it was, yeah, I think, colonel, yeah, that's right, he was colonel, yes. He commanded the 1st 8th there, and he was also station commander, because in Multan there, you had one, two, three, it's quite a big station, one, two, three Indian battalions and the Sherwood Foresters, the British battalion.
Can you tell me about your year with the Sherwood Foresters at Multan?
Yes, they were very fair. You carry on the work of a normal subaltern and so on. I think they welcomed us, because you've got to remember that in those days the trouble of the British Army was the lack of promotion prospects. It's the most extraordinary thing to think that we had two subalterns, and I remember them well, two lieutenants in the Sherwood Foresters, one of whom had got 17 years service and the other had got 18 years service. Now, these chaps had in fact passed their promotion exam three times. They needn't have, but they were asked to do it to keep up to a date. But it was Boggins' turn. There was no room for them. They never got a chance of becoming captain. And therefore, they found themselves doing orderly dog and all these humdrum things that you expect young subalterns to do, and there were chaps of 17, 18 years of service, some of them with World War I service. It's ridiculous. And so they welcome ULIA people, because just a few more, apart from the others, chaps to do some of the ordinary duties of a subaltern, like on the rifle range and orderly dogs and all these things that subalterns do when they first join a regiment.
Orderly dogs?
They're always known as orderly dogs. Orderly officers are always known as orderly dogs, yeah.
So, were you happy to do these routine things?
Well, you took it for granted. Yes, it was part of your training. You learnt. I learnt from them, and I will say, it wasn't the same with all British battalions. There were some British battalions who were very hard in the ULIA because they were not going to join the regiment in the end, and they were there just for a short time, who treated them really pretty badly, but not the foresters. They were extremely good. They treated you in exactly the same way as they'd have treated one of their own officers.
How did the British troops react to you as a very young officer?
Well, like any, and I, as I said at the beginning, one of our troubles and embarrassing was that we had so little practical training, in fact you may say nil, about the sort of thing that you expect the ordinary private soldier to be able to do, like fire a rifle. In those days, fire a Lewis gun, a revolver, throw a grenade, all these things which they were trained to do, you then found yourself, and they quickly sensed that you really knew nothing about it at all. And before you went on parade in the morning, when you were supposed to teach them how to throw a grenade and so on, was that you had to get down to your manual and read it up as best you can. You'd never done it. There was no other way of doing it. One simply did. I remember with Walter Walker, two of us looking at our books and saying, well, it looks as though you hold it this way, you see. It raised a remarkable situation. You can't imagine it today. And there we commissioned officers.
It's a wonder the soldiers didn't feel contemptuous then.
Well, they didn't. But, of course, discipline was very strong. You've got to remember in those days, recruiting for the British Army, the private soldier was a pretty, though I say it myself to a large extent, a rather low-grade chap. The foresters recruited from the minefields, Derbyshire and Nottinghamshire. That's where they came from. Their pay was quite terrible. Their food was even worse. It really was quite dreadful. I don't know how they sort of... And the only reason they were there at all was, of course, unemployment. It was that, and can't remember what the dole was, if there was hardly any dole at all. And this is you can't expect much, really, professionalism from troops who are in that state of mind. And we've got to remember that in those days, and this is strongly looking back on it, there was no form of entertainment for the troops. Naturally, there was no television, there was no radio. Basically, the whole trouble was to keep them away from the women and keep the rate of VD down. And so you had to...